Okay, so thank you everyone for coming. Very excited to be giving my first Tanakh Club on Chabura. Big thank you to Alex Magid for facilitating, and it's a nice club because it provides a really nice opportunity for, you know, people, for all of us, and today it's me, but for all of us to, you know, prepare our own Torah, think about it, and then share it with friends. So thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for coming. So today this is an exciting topic, and one that I did a lot of research on this summer, preparing for NCSY Kol. I was Madrich, and part of that is creating a whole series of shiurim. And so this was like the research that I did, and this was actually a longer series, and I condensed it and kind of refined it into one shiur. So it's action-packed, it's a lot of fun, and it should be good. So the title is The Concept of Covenant, The Evolution of the Brit Relationship. And so we begin, the Torah, already in the second parak, notices and recognizes the fact that man is a social creature, right, and deems it as negative, as a bad thing for man to be alone. So already here in Bereishit Perek Bet, Pasuk Yachab, Yudchet, specifically, Vayomer Hashem Elokim, Lo Tov Hayod Adam Lado, right? It's explicitly not good for man to be alone. Yet, despite the fact that this is not a positive thing, we know that Adam, specifically the first man, and also just people in general, start their lives and start off alone, right? And God, in the famous story, brings all the animals in front of Adam, and nonetheless, he realizes that he is still alone. Pasuk Chaf. Well, Adam lo matza ezer kenegdo. Adam didn't have an ezer kenegdo. So too, it really is, I guess, the start of every man and every woman, which is that they don't really have, at least initially in life, don't really have the ezer kenegdo. And thus, as a result of that, says Eric Fromm in the first English source here in his book *The Art of Love Digging*. Eric Fromm, interestingly, was a prominent psychologist who also did a lot of writing in the 20th century. Interestingly, he was actually grew up in a religious household and was religious until young adulthood when he decided to go on another path. But in this book specifically, *The Art of Loving*, which is a fascinating read, he's not shy about quoting both Tanakh, but also even you know, relevant citations from the Talmud. So, an interesting read. But says Eric Fromm, this desire for the interpersonal fusion is the most powerful striving in man. It is the most fundamental passion. It is the source which keeps the human race together, the clan, the family, the society. The failure to achieve it means insanity or destruction, self-destruction or destruction of others. Without love, humanity could not exist for a day. Yet, if we call the achievement of interpersonal union love, we find ourselves in a serious difficulty. Fusion can be achieved in different ways, and the differences are not less significant than what is common to the various forms of love. Should they all be called love? Or should we reserve the word love only for specific kinds of union? One which has been the ideal virtue in all great humanistic religions and philosophical systems of the last 4,000 years of Western and Eastern history. Right, so a bold statement there. And so, for Fromm, the goal of these philosophical systems and Western and Eastern histories, or at least this ideal virtue that is something to strive for, is this idea of love, what he terms love. And I think it's not that any type of relationship is considered love. As he says, there's a number of different fusions, ways of fusion, ways of creating relationship. But what he's suggesting is that we reserve love for this specific type of relationship. He doesn't define it here what it is, but for some ideal type of relationship. And what Fromm calls love, I think, is very parallel and has a lot of similarities to what Rabbi Sacks terms and refers to in Brit in his writings. And Rabbi Sacks goes on to say, not only is this an ideal virtue, this kind of relationship, but in the source here, that this is an idea on which eventually all of Jewish history will turn, the idea of a covenant of a Brit. And it fits, and Rabbi Sacks, lest you think that Rabbi Sacks isn't really serious, that he thinks this is such a central, you know, idea in Judaism, his weekly Parsha email is called Covenant and Conversation. So clearly, the covenant of relationship is at the forefront of his mind. And you can even see the covenant is obviously in bold and very, very visible. So I've been a fan of Rabbi Sacks and his parsha emails for a couple of years now. And for a while, they were doing, it wasn't just a text, but he was actually then, they were recording Rabbi Sacks, like in his study, speaking out the idea of the parsha. And obviously with the accent and everything, it was overwhelming. So I was taken with it, and I was working out. I worked on my accent for a couple years, and then I was in Moshava 2 years ago. I was a Rosh Yeda, and so we did a tish for like the older campers, and we tried to do a theme every week. Me and Jeremy Schechter, for those of you who know. So we came up with different themes each week. So one week we did Scottish, and he wore a kilt, Jeremy, which was I was obviously jealous of. And then another week we did the British, and this time I'm going to dress up like Rabbi Sacks, speak in a British accent, and give over his weekly parsha. So we get to the Tish, and I'm doing it, and I'm really getting into it. I think it's going great. The kids look like they're paying attention. And then finally, a girl raises her hand to ask a question. And I'm like, oh, this is great. Like, they're clearly engaged. She's going to ask a question. Like, this is amazing. I'm pulling off the Rabbi Sacks thing. I've always wanted to do this. This is a dream come true. And she raises her hand, and then she says, why is it that your accent keeps changing? So needless to say, that was a major bubble burst for me. And I haven't really done the impersonation public since. But nonetheless, the point is that covenant is clearly a major theme for Rabbi Sacks. And so what I want to do tonight is to follow this Brit relationship as it develops, identify some of the elements, the characteristics of what a Brit is, and study also the instances in Tanakh where it's actually misconstrued, where the Brit relationship, even though it's called a Brit, isn't really a true covenantal relationship in the ideal sense. And then understanding what the Brit is will then help us recognize perhaps the most central Brit in Tanakh, which is the Brit between God and Abraham. We'll make an argument about that. And it will help us understand the Brit between God and Abraham and shed light on the purpose of the Brit between God and Abraham. So that's the overview of what we're going to do. But I want to start even before the source that we discussed about the social element of man. Even before that in the Torah is the idea of Shabbat, that God rests on the seventh day. And within a Shabbat, a specific understanding of Shabbat, is actually the precondition of relationship. What do I mean? Explain to Rabbi Foreman. Well, sorry, he points out the textual question in Shabbat, which is why does it say in Pasuk Perek Bet, Bereishit Perek Bet, Pasuk Bet, why does it say that God both by Echal Elohim by Yom HaShviim Lachto Asher Asa and by Yishmod by Yom HaShviim Mikom Lachto Asher Asa? How did God both rest and abstain from work, but also complete His work? Right? If I were to tell you that I finished all my homework yesterday, and then I would say I took a day off and didn't do my homework yesterday, those things would seemingly be contradictory. So how is it? What is it exactly that God was doing? And to understand that, we have to understand the nature of the creative act, thanks to our good friend Eric Fromm, who you'll be seeing in love. So it says Fromm in the English source on the bottom of page 1, a third way of attaining union lies in creative activity, be it that of an artist or of the artisan. In any kind of creative work, the creating person unites himself with his material, which represents the world outside of himself. Whether a carpenter makes a table or a goldsmith a piece of jewelry, whether the peasant grows his corn or the painter paints a picture, in all types of creative work, the worker and his object become one. Man unites himself with the world in the process of creation. Explains Rabbi Foreman that when God was creating, in the 6 days that he was creating and tinkering with the creation, in a sense, God and creation were one. Right? Creation had not yet obtained its own independent status as long as God was creating it. Only when God then took it, stopped the tinkering, stopped the act of creating, Tzimtzum, whatever you want to call it, on the seventh day, that created an independent status for creation, right? And so in ending and stopping his creative work, God, in fact, was completing the creative process by allowing for his creation to have its own independent existence, have its own integrity. And so that essentially is the precondition for relationship, right? In order to be able to create the relationship that Brit will talk about, you first have to have that respect for the independence of the other, right? Respecting the other as another individual, which then you can form a relationship between these two individuals. So despite the fact that God kind of laid out this truth about respecting this independence, we see in the relationships that are termed Brito, in the Brito that come up early on in Bereishit, we see that this wasn't honored necessarily by the formers of those who formed the covenant. The first, and I split this in deference to play, while you play, which is going on. I split this. The shiur is divided between acts and scenes. Okay, so we'll start first with Act 1. Act 1 is covenant misconstrued. Two scenes, two examples where covenant is misunderstood, is misconceived by human beings. And the first one was Avram and Mamre. Now Mamre, we don't know a lot about this guy, but in Bereishit, Parsha Lech Lecha Perek Yudal, it explains by Yavoha Palit, the refugees, remaining people, the people who escaped from the war of the four and the five kings, came by Yagel Avram Ha'ivri, and they told Avram, who shochein ve'lo ne Mamre Hamori, and he was dwelling in this place controlled by Mamre, who was Achi Eshko v'Achi Aner, the brother of Eshko and Aner, Behem Ba'alei Vrit Avram, and they were the Ba'alim, the masters of a Brit with Avram. So we don't know much about the nature of this brief. Where Hirsch actually gives us some insight into what the relationship was and how it misconstrued what we think is the ideal relationship. So it says Rav Hirsch in the second source, Baal, the term Baal, mitzayenet hayachas shebein adam lebein etzem hamishubal. Right? The term Baal is talking about someone who's a master and then something that's enslaved him, so to speak. Yesh shnei sugim shel brit. And here he explains there's two types of brit. Aleph, brit hakrita bein shavim, a brit that's sealed between two equal parties. And bet, brit bein shnayim she'enam shavim be'achad, two who aren't equal in terms of their value status. Ha'achad mekabel ha'sheni be'brit ha'yedidut u'mitzaref oto le'chevrato. One is accepting the other into a brit, but it's adding the person into your chevra, right? And explain, skipping then to the bold, Rav Hirsch explains that what did Aner Eshkol and Mamre doing? It wasn't that they were creating a brit between equals between Avraham. They saw Avraham as someone below them, I guess, someone who they were trying to subjugate, who they were trying to, in the bold, sirfuhu lechevratam, they were trying to include him, incorporate him, swallow him, so to speak, into their chevra. In a sense, what they were doing is kind of reversing the process of creation we just mentioned. Right? God, in creating, was united with his creation, and then created the separation, this respect for the independence, the integrity of the other. Whereas Aner and Eshkol and Mamre with Avram are trying to reverse that and trying to fuse with Avram, but not a fusion of brit, which we'll discuss, but rather this kind of fusion of dominance where Avram would be Mishubad Lahem. And explains Eric Fromm in the next English quote, the active form of symbiotic fusion is domination, or, to use the psychological term corresponding to masochism, sadism. The sadistic person wants to escape from his aloneness and his sense of imprisonment by making another person part and parcel of himself. He inflates and enhances himself by incorporating another person who worships him, or in this case is Mishubadlo. And the example I think of is on the summer program this summer, there was a rabbi who after a hike was like kind of making fun of himself about how out of shape he was and how tired he was on the hike. And he was joking that we were, you know, hiking in a line or whatever. He was joking that he was breathing so hard he thought he was going to suck in the guy in front of him. Right? And so it's just like a visual, I guess, to help you picture what the nature of this relationship is here, which is where Aner Eshkol and Mamre are trying to kind of suck Avram in, right? Deny his own individuality and make him part of their chevra. So that's scene one. Okay, and there, again, it's the violation of the respect for independence. In scene two, we have Avram Avimelech, where it seems that there is, for all intents and purposes, respect for this independence, but there's a different issue here with the brit. Okay, now this whole perek chavalef in Breishi, where it's describing the relationship between Avram and Avimelech, is kind of confusing. Basically, what happens is Avimelech and Pichol, his lead officer, come to Avram, and Avimelech basically makes Avram swear that Avram and his descendants will be honest and will be, you know, do chesed with Avimelech and his descendants. And then Avram comes back, and in Pasuk Chafei, Ve'ochiach Avram et Avimelech, alodot ber hamayim asher gazlu al ber hamayim. And then Avram comes right back and rebukes Avimelech over these wells that Avimelech's servants stole from Avram. And then Avram makes Avimelech basically kind of give or admit that the wells belong to him. And then Avram gives seven sheep as kind of like an oath or a sign of this brit. Now, Rav Hirsch kind of has an interesting explanation about why Avram is giving the sheep and what's going on, how it's a kinyan sudar, which is a halachic term that comes out later. But the interesting thing is that in this brit, it seems like kind of a transaction is going on, right? Avimelech and Avram meet. Avimelech wants something from Avram. He wants an assurance from him that Avram will be nice to his descendants. And Avram, almost, you can picture him listening to Avimelech and like waiting impatiently because he has something he wants to say. He has something he wants to get out of the conversation, right? He wants a promise, an admission, whatever it is. And so both parties here are kind of looking simply to gain from the other, and there's no really relationship forming here. So if you look, turn to page 3, you'll see these nice little comments here at the top. That here is that the brief between Avram and Avimelech, is really nothing more than a contract. It's like a transaction, right? Avram wants a certain assurance, promise, something from Avimelech. He wants something from him, right? I need your service, and I need your service. There's no relationship really being formed. And so to summarize what we've seen so far, right, these two stories of Breishit, the first one lacked in the respecting of independence, which is necessary for the pre-relationship, for any relationship building. And the second one here, it's kind of just a contractual business deal, more than really the forming of relationship. So the obvious question now, first of all, are there any questions before we continue? Questions or thoughts? Yeah,
so I Are these like covenants misconstrued in the sense that like these are not covenants and they thought they were, but they got it all wrong and misconstrued them? Or are these like covenants, just they're not like, you know, they're not like God in Israel or God in Abraham or whatever?
Right, so good question. So I would say it does, the Torah does use Greek to refer to these relationships or whatever these interactions are. So I guess my argument to you is that although it says Brit, the real, I guess, ideal Brit relationship, the form of real ideal Brit relationship, we are going to see in the form of God and Noach a little bit, but really God and Avraham, that relationship. And that these are, for whatever reason, you know, not living up to, I guess, what the ideal Brit relationship should be, even though the Torah calls it that. With me? Kind of? So, any other questions, comments? Okay, so with that, we move to Act 2 now. Act 2, it only has one scene, I believe, but this is now the relationship with God and Noach. So after the Mabul, right, we have God comes to Noach, and here in Breishit Perek Tet, Pasuk Zayin, he says, "Tempru ruvur shisu ba'aretz buruvah." He says to Noach and his family, right, that, and really, and then he also says to all of creation that they should multiply and spread throughout the earth. And then in the following Pesukim, God goes and explains that he will establish a brit with Noach and Pasuk Yud Aleph, "Kimoti et briti itchem," I'll establish a brit with you and really all of creation. "V'lo yikaret kol basar od mimei ha-mabul," I won't destroy the rest of creation with the waters of a mabul, of a flood. "V'lo yikaret od mabul l'shachet ha-aretz," and there won't be another mabul to destroy the world. And then in Pasuk Yud Bet, he says that the oath of the brit, the sign, the symbol of the covenant, is the keshet, is the rainbow. And so the question is here, right, we talk about the precondition of being respect for independence. Does that exist here? Right? So even without the text, I would make the argument, and feel free to disagree, that the respect for independence and for the integrity of the other is almost implicit in the fact that even after all of mankind sins and is then required, you know, is then deserving of destruction, God still allows man to keep his bechirah chavshi, keep his free choice. So for me, even that simple implicit fact kind of means that God is respecting man's independence here, right? God could have very easily said, "Listen, you know, you had to run, you kind of lost it, you don't really deserve this anymore," taken away and then basically made man almost like, you know, an unthinking creature. And I think that by allowing man to still have that free choice, it seems like he is still maintaining that, wanting that independence and wanting that ability to have that relationship. But with that independence then comes the, I guess, the flip side of the coin, or the tension that arises is explained here by Rabbi Sachs when he says that the key question of social life is how can there be a stable relationship between two free individuals? How can one respect freedom of another while endowing the bond between them with permanence so that it becomes the bond of trust? Right? Respecting the independence is great, but how then do you create a connection? Do you create the relationship? And the answer to that is in the next quote here, that just as God creates the natural world, and I like this one a lot, just as God creates the natural world with words, so we create the social world with words, sacred words, meaning words that bind. And so in the relationship here between God and Noah, the words here, the which is really the kind of a promise, I guess, is in God's promise that he won't destroy the world anymore. And says the Malcolm in the next source, "Vayomer lahim achar shekarati mo'abrit," and then in parentheses, these are key here, "she'abrit hi atzma ha'shua," that brit and shua are totally interconnected. "She'amar asher nishvati me'avor me'noach od al pa'aretz," God swore that he wouldn't bring any more mabul. "Ki im kritat brit ba'shua tami," because whenever there's the creation of a covenant, right, a shua, this promise that binds the parties together, that's kind of, I guess, the mechanism that makes it happen. Right, so the aspects we have so far, one, respect for independence, which is the precondition, and then two, the mechanism by which it happens is this promise, is the shua, these words that bind together. And I think this is summarized nicely, and then the third element is brought here in the next quote by Rabbi Sachs. "A covenant is made when free agents, respecting one another's freedom," there's number one, "bind themselves by a mutual promise," there's number two, "to work together, to be loyal to one another, and to achieve together what neither can achieve alone." So I'd like to collapse that last line into, I guess, what I think is the third element of the covenant, which is kind of working together to achieve what either cannot achieve alone. It's essentially, I guess, a joint goal that the two parties have, and they're working together on. So the question then is there a joint goal between God and Noah? Right? God made the promise that he's not going to destroy the world again. So what, I guess, might be the joint goal that God and Noah would have, if there is one? Any thoughts? No? What'd you say?
Rebuilding the world.
Rebuilding the world, okay. Is that what you're going to say to me? Yeah, and so Rashi here on Pasuk Tet connects the tzivui, the command that God makes of Pru Urvu Shirtu Haaretz, the command that God makes to Noah and the rest of the nation, they should fill the world. And he connects that to then God's promise not to destroy the world. And then the Radak says explicitly, really, I think what Sam said about the joint goal, says the Radak, Vani hini mekim vav, va'ani mosif, amasha mar vatem puruvu. The vav in va'ani hini, the vav at the beginning of that God's introduction of the covenant connects his promise to not destroy the world with his command for man to fill up the world. Says the Radak, klomar atem titasku b'yishuv ha'olam, God saying, you, man, will be busy with Yishuv HaOlam, Vani Gam Kein Akimenu. And I'm also going to do my part in making sure there's Yishuv HaOlam, Shelo Yikarek Od Yishuvo Shalom. Now, God's is more of a passive in that he's not just not going to destroy the world. But in a sense, you can make the argument that the joint goal here is Yishuv HaOlam. Man's going to do so by having kids, by spreading throughout the world, and God will do so by not destroying the world, however much, you know, man may sin or whatever will happen. Yeah, Shmuel.
Is this verse so fundamentally different than the brief that we saw earlier that were mystically true? Because in this case as well, you have both parties, you know, coming together so they could accomplish something they wouldn't be able to do by themselves. So in other words, before, with, I guess, at least Avraham enough, I guess, the point was, we said the verse over there was mystically true because they each had their own agenda, and they kind of needed each other. Here as well, though, you can make, I think, very well make the case that both are coming together, like you said, because they can't achieve it by themselves. And so they're coming together, again, each with their own agenda to accomplish what they want, and they could only do it so with the other party. So do you see this verse as fundamentally different than the previous?
Yeah. Can you use a separate question? Or
no, I was going to, kind of.
Yeah.
I think that the difference here is that there's a positive content, which is what you refer to as element number three. They're trying to accomplish something together. Masha Einkin with Avram and Abimelech, it's just, you don't mess with me and I don't mess with you, but there's no positive content of us trying to build anything.
Right. I would say also, right, like, true that both have the agenda and both have, I guess, separate responsibilities, but it seems like the agendas are converging towards one specific positive content, I think is that what I'm saying. Yeah.
Also, can God, like, get really anything done when he wants to? He doesn't need Noah to get anything done.
Right.
He's kind of just...
True. Sure.
It's very anti-Kabbalah.
Kabbalah
is very into the fact that human beings, their existence is the completion of God's inability to do finite items.
Right. And I would say, true, right, God obviously, if he really wanted to, could do it alone. But I guess that's kind of the Judaism, in my mind, and Judaism kind of empowerment of man, is God, you know, specifically doesn't and leaves room for that man has to then fill in that gap. And you could say Tzimtzum, yeah, whatever words you want to throw around. Yeah.
One thing that's interesting about this particular breed is that it's not bilateral. You'd expect that if the parties are equal, and that if they've got a mutual promise to work together, then you have some sort of bilateral relationship in this breed. And yet, here, all we have is God talking to Noah. We don't even have, as if I recall correctly, it's not certainly not in Shema, I don't even recall there being like a Yas Noah or any sort of sign that Noah is accepting this breed. There's certainly no addition by Noah to the terms of the breed. And it seems to be entirely unilateral, which, you know, for a sort of agreement relationship that both sides are expected to contribute to, both sides are expected to be integral parts of, and where both sides really respect one another's freedom, a unilateral initiation of that relationship would seem unexpected.
Right. Excellent point. Yeah.
First of all, God, you can't really compare a God relationship with another person in the same way you compare two people, right? They're not talking necessarily face-to-face to each other. But also, if you see it says, I'm not from my now, you see that the children of Noah actually take an active role in, you know, like, multiplying the world and everything. So you can say, you don't necessarily see them in the text, but you could say that, you don't say that they necessarily said, yes, I agree. Rather, they actually actively... It's something that's uncomfortable even for them just to kind of
Right.
I mean, just to respond to both of those points. Number one, the fact that God cannot, you know, relate to man in the same way that man relates to man doesn't necessarily make it less of a problem. In other words, that would sort of seem to raise a larger question. In other words, how can God make things both in general? And I mean, certainly if you look at Brunei has other examples of breeds,
yeah.
So I'll hold off on Brunei textual evidence for now. But there are other, you know, breeds where man is complicit, so to speak, in the formation of the breed. And here I don't really see that. And like the Elbanavi totally more, but I mean it's still like God is speaking too.
Yeah,
it's right.
It's very it's an excellent point, Debbie, last point.
Yeah, it's definitely not in the text, but I will say that Rosenzweig spoke for a long time I was a little upset. The first question was Kiddush. About how actually Noach does take certain initiative in this, and as a response to his actions, Hashem does all this. And in fact, all of this is just a continued speech to Noach's coming out of the Teva and giving, doing a korban, which in general, like splitting animals, is seen as right. Is like an action of breed.
Right.
So it seems like he actually might be initiated.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Good point. Both sides are extremely valid. And yet, to Danny's point, it's an excellent point. Definitely in the text, right? It seems like it is sort of a little bit unilateral. And we'll see that. You know, we'll compare this then with the Avraham God breed. But at the same time, you could make the argument that there is a little bit more mutuality than at first glance. So just to summarize so far, in terms of the elements of breed. So we saw the first one. The precondition was that there be independence in the respect for independence. The second one, the mechanism by which the breed is formed, is the shvua, and the shvua relates, right, and informs or can inform us about number three, which is like the substance, I guess, the joint goal of the two, right? The shvua here is that God won't destroy the world, which is related to the joint goal of Yishuv HaOlam. And the number four, which we didn't mention but is here also, is the oath, right? Here is the rainbow, and the oath sometimes is related to the joint goal, right? Like different commentators try to explain why the rainbow is related to God not destroying the world. But sometimes, you know, like kind of for the sheep in the Avram and Abimelech relationship, sometimes it doesn't really seem so related. So that's something to keep in mind. But we're still lacking a fifth element, which is a more transformational element, which we'll see. And so now as we move into the final breed we're going to discuss, the big breed, the breed of all breeds, as you could say, the breed between God and Avram, we're going to see, I guess, the full realization now of the ideal breeds. And then our model of breed will then actually inform our understanding of the breed between God and Adam. So here we go. Okay, so again, even just before we get to the text, right, the question is, what is there independence between God, or sorry, is there respect for independence between God and Adam? And although it's not necessarily, I guess, explicit in the text, it does seem that, based off just their knowledge about their relationship, you could, again, make the argument that there is this respect for independence. A, the Midrashim talk about how Adam actually had to find God, which maybe relating, or I guess countering, what Danny's problem was with the previous breed. So A, the Midrashim make that point, and then just B, that in terms of the Pshat, right, Avram, for example, arguing with God over stone, certainly seems that there is this respect for independence for the other opinion, however you understand it. And so now we move into scene one of this third act of God, the breed between God and Avram, which is the breed Bein HaBetarim. And what I want to take out of the Bein HaBetarim is specifically the Shavua here, which I think is the Shavua that is the mechanism by which this breed is created. Says the Torah in Perek Tevav, Pasuk Yuchad of Bereishit, Bayom HaKarat Adonai et Avram Brit Lemor, Zarachan Atati et Eretz Hazo, Min HaMitzrayim Ad HaNahar Gadol Nahar Parah. Now the Shavua here is the promise that God will give to Avram and his descendants, Eretz Yisrael. Okay, that comes up a lot, and specifically here in the Bein HaBetarim, that is the Shavua on which the breed is founded. Now we move to scene two, so that's number two, right? The mechanism, the Shavua, seems to be the promise of Eretz Yisrael. And then, now we move to scene two. And scene two, interestingly, seems to be, in various sources, seems to be, I guess, extremely significant as far as understanding Greek goes. So much so that the Rambam in Hilchot Milah contrasts the giving of the Torah, the breed of the Torah, right? The Kol Mitzvot HaTorah Nichratu Alehen Shalosh Britot, three Britot on all the Mitzvot of the Torah, in contrast to Baal HaMilah Nichratu Shlosh Esrei Britot Im Avraham Avinu. There were 13. Now, it could just be that this is simply a textual note, as we'll see. It does say it 13 times during the whole Brit Milah passage, but it also seems to be emphasizing the significance of this breed. And I want to suggest that the significance is both in terms of its status as the paradigmatic breed, having all five elements, which we'll discuss, but also in terms of the substance, right? We talked about number three is the substance of the breed, the joint goal, right? And that the substance of the breed here is going to be, I guess, the foundation for the Jewish mission and for what Judaism really is all about. So let's start with filling in that fifth element of breed to complete our model. And so within this whole paragraph in Perek Yud Zayin, the beginning of Perek Yud Zayin, where God talks to Avram and reestablishes and re-emphasizes the breed that he's going to make with him, and he gives over the command of Brit Milah, within this whole exchange in Pasuk Hey and Pasuk Devav, Sarah or Sarai and Avram get their name changes, right? They each get the Hey added in. Okay? And so the question is it coincidence that specifically it's within this context of the Brit, explosion of Brit references here, is it a coincidence that this is where their name gets changed? Of course, I don't think it is. But the name change here, I'd like to suggest, is not the same name change as someone who, I guess, is as another famous person in our day, Lahavdil Al-Fayyab, namely Ron Artest. You see the picture here. And it was a big success to be able to work in a picture of Ron Artest to the Mikoro. But Ron Artest is a basketball player. He was involved in some altercations and a big brawl at one point in his career, and presumably, or at least the way I understood it, in order to kind of improve his image, he changed his name to Mehta, first name Mehta, World Peace. You can see his jersey here, which has a World Peace in the back. An interesting fellow, and he'll only get more interesting in a second when I tell you his next name change, but presumably the point of this name change was in order to kind of improve his reputation. However, today, as I was printing these Mikoro, I found out that he's working on getting his name changed again. He's now playing in China basketball because he's kind of on the decline of his career. And I heard today that he wants to change his name to the Panda's Friend. The Panda's Friend. The Panda's Friend. And I have a picture here. I have a picture here of Ron Artest, what he did in a game. He wore shoes which had a stuffed panda built into the shoes. What this makes me realize is that it probably was not only trying to improve his image, but was actually really more of a cry for attention, the whole name change thing. But whatever Ron Artest's motivation was, these motivations are not the motivations behind the name change of Avram and Sarah. And what I'd like to suggest is that the name changes here demonstrate the fifth element of the Brit. Namely, the transformation that happens when two individuals transform from me, into we. Right? And that there's a certain added transformation that happens in this Brit, and I have this little nice graphic with the M and the W and the me to the we, and that there's a fusion, there's a unity, the kind of fusion that Eric Fromm talked about earlier, unity of becoming one, that happens in this Brit between God and Avram and Sarah. And the flip side of this, right, is that even though they're fusing, they're still maintaining that respect for the other's independence, that respect for the other's integrity. And if you look at the bottom source here, on page 4, Fromm says, in contrast to symbiotic union, mature love is union under the condition of preserving one's integrity, one's individuality. Love is an active power in man, a power which breaks through the walls which separate man from his fellow man, which unites him with others. Love makes him overcome the sense of isolation and separateness, yet it permits him to be himself, to retain his integrity. In love, the paradox occurs that two beings become one, yet remain two. Right? And so that, I think, is the added element that's happening here with the Brit between God and Avram. So that's the fifth element of Brit, is this fusion. But I want to go back. Right? We still haven't established what's the third element, right? The joint goal between God and Avram. And I want to use the model that we've created of Brit in order to understand it. Right? And so what's the evidence we have so far? We know that there was a Shvuah, right? That's the mechanism that creates the Brit. The Shvuah is God giving Eretz Yisrael to Avram and his descendants. So that's the Shvuah. We know Shvuah, in general, are related to the substance, the joint goal of the Brit. And then the question is the Ot here, the other potential evidence we could have, right, potential proof or hint, is the Ot, right? Ot, we said, is sometimes related to the joint goal, to the substance, but sometimes not. How do we determine this? So here, explicitly, I think it is. Why? Because it explains to Hirsch on the next page 5, for Hirsch notes an issue in the text. It first explained that Brit Milah is the Briti, Zot Briti, and then in the next passage it said Ot Brit. So is Milah the Brit itself, or is it the sign of the covenant? Says Rav Hirsch, Yesh lasim lev lekach, she'amilah atzma kriya kan Brit. Milah itself is called Brit here. Hava Omer, etzem ma'aseh ha'milah yesh bo mishum shmirat ha'brit. Within the Milah itself, there is an element, or a taste, I guess, of the actual fulfilling of the Brit. Ve'ilu b'psuk ha'sheni, he kriya Ot Brit. But then in the second passage it's called the Ot, the sign of the covenant. Ot ha-misameled et ha-brit, the Ot that symbolizes the covenant. Skipping to the bold at the end, v'yesh pegach kidei l'ha-midenu al-tiv kol shara mitzvot ha-demol. And so the Brit is not only the sign of the Brit, but it also is an inherent part of the fulfillment of the Brit itself, which I think indicates to us that this can also be a source of evidence when in trying to find out what exactly the Brit is, what exactly the Brit's doing, what's the purpose, what is the joint goal. And to drive home what I think this joint goal might be. I want to quote this source here from Michael Wishegrad, who's a prominent Jewish theologian, who I think actually Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik wrote his, I think, thesis on. He has a number of interesting works, one of them being the body of faith, which is his kind of idea of what Judaism is and what the purpose of it is. And so I want to read this piece here, which I think captures the joint goal that comes out of this understanding of breed when applied to this breed between God and Avraham. So skipping now about halfway through to the italicized, he says, here again, God could have played a godly role, interested in certain features of human existence, the spiritual, but not others, the material. He could even have assigned man the task of wrenching himself out of the material so as to assume his spiritual identity, which is just what so many religions believe he did. Instead, the God of Israel confirms man, as he created him, to live in the material cosmos. There is therefore no possibility of a divine requirement for the discarding of a part of human existence. And here's the bull. Instead, there is a requirement for the sanctification of human existence in all of its aspects. Israel's symbol of the covenant is circumcision, a searing of the covenant into the flesh of Israel, and not only, or perhaps not even primarily, into its spirit. And so I think from this passage, and based off what we know about the brief itself, you can say that the joint goal here is, I guess, the human service of God with man's entire being, body and soul, physical and spiritual. Why? Because as Wishegrad explains, because man is both of those things, and you can't make a bifurcation between the two, as he says earlier, is inconsistent, is forced. So the question then, if that's then the goal, so the question, obvious question is, what does God contribute? And what we said with the Shavua was that God is contributing Eretz Yisrael. Now, why is that fitting? Because Eretz Yisrael is also both physical and spiritual, right? It's a holy thing, which is both physical and spiritual, and it enables then the Jewish people to live a life of service to God in both the physical and the spiritual. So God is, I guess, providing us the means by which we can achieve this goal of serving God with the entire being. Okay? So that is, you could argue, you know, obviously Judaism being as complex and as deep as it is, you could argue a number of things in terms of what the joint goal is. But that, I think, taking the Shavua and the Ode and trying to glean from those what exactly the goal is, I think you can make a compelling argument for what Wishegrad is saying. And so to close, I just want to move back and look at what we've learned about breed as a whole. And I made this fancy little graph for you. So the five elements, the precondition, right, which is respecting the independence of the other, which, as Fromm said, is the anti-sadism that trying to take the other person and kind of swallow them, include them within yourself. That's respect for independence. Number two is the mechanism by which it happens, the shavua, which is practical but informs us about number three. Number three is the substance, which is the joint goal, which is, I guess, part of what distinguishes between a covenant, a brit, and a contract. Number four, the reminder, the oat, which, again, is this practical sign of the covenant, but also sometimes, and specifically in this instance, relates to number three, the joint goal. And then number five, as we showed with the name change of Avram and Sarah, is this identity change, right? This coming together, this fusion between the two parties. And so to finish off, I want to finish off with this really nice quote from Rabbi Sachs. The question, obviously, is then how does this, you know, taking this now to our own lives, how does this help us, you know, rise above, escape our own loneliness, and to create this kind of breed ideal relationship, both on the individual level and on the societal group level. And I think Rabbi Sachs explained it beautifully, and we'll close with this, and then whoever has questions or comments or want to, you know, throw the whole thing down the drain, whatever floats your boat. So here is Rabbi Sachs. The covenantal bond is the only way of reconciling freedom with association. It allows us to make marriages, families, communities, and eventually societies built on the recognition of our independence and interdependence. It will eventually lead to the greatest of man's attempts to create a social order based on the absolute dignity of the individual as in the image of God. So that is, I think, based off my research and some conclusions, the concept of covenant. Thank you guys all for coming. If anyone has questions, own ideas, whatever, feel free. Questions? Anybody? And if anyone wants to go, feel free before we do the questions.